Are you looking to connect with a diverse audience of developers? Look no further. You can partner with us here at the Code Newbie Podcast, and we'll help get your message out to our incredible listeners in an ad just like this one, led by me, your host. Contact us by emailing sponsors@codenewbie.org. Welcome to the Code Newbie Podcast, where we talk to people on their coding journey in hopes of helping you on yours. I'm your host, Saran, and before we kick off the show, I want to tell you about our incredible sponsors. I'm your host, Saran, and today we're talking to developer and testing guru. Is that like a fair word? not quite.
Guy who focused enough to write a book once.
Okay, that works. Noel Rapin. Noel, you want to say hi?
Hi.
I love your last name, by the way. I know I've told you that before, but I really like your last name. It's an awesome last name.
Thank you. I thank the ancestor of mine who thought to change it after coming over on Ellis Island.
Very smart ancestor.
And had no idea, really.
So you wrote a new book on testing called Rails for Test Prescriptions. And as a listener, if you don't know what any of those words mean, that's okay. Don't worry. We're going to explain everything. We're going to go really slowly, right, Noel?
Yep.
Okay. So let's start with the testing part. What is testing?
Well, okay. One of the interesting things about having this discussion overall is that different people sometimes mean different things when they talk about testing. And it can get really confusing if you're trying to debate whether testing is valuable or not when one person is talking about one kind of testing and another person is talking about another kind of test. So testing can mean all kinds of different things in a programming context. It can mean that you have somebody whose job title involves QA, quality assurance, who goes through your program manually. Like, this is historically what testing was. Somebody would manually have some kind of checklist of things to there'd be some kind of manual test plan where of steps to take to verify that the application was behaving the way it was intended. And that was, of course, a manual and somewhat time-consuming process. And then eventually that also, you know, that turned into automated testing where various mechanisms were introduced to allow you to script a program to interact, again, after the fact to verify that the program was behaving as intended. You know, this kind of thing lives on in Selenium or the kinds of automatic the kinds of tools that capture interactions and replay them back to a program or just in general scripting languages. And then eventually people decided, specifically in this context, a guy named Kent Beck started to have the idea that testing had this reputation for being very hard to do. And he decided that one of the reasons why testing computer programs was difficult was because the tests were frequently written much later than the actual code. And so he started experimenting with the idea that of writing a small bit of code and a small test and going back and forth. And eventually that led to the idea of writing the test first, that you would start your process by writing a small test and then write a small bit of code and then come back and write a small test. And he started off by calling that test first development, and it eventually became test-driven design as he sort of experimented with that idea and discovered that one of the advantages of working in that mode of writing the tests first is it enabled you to use the tests to understand the code that you're trying to write, to use it as a way to make design decisions about the way the code would be structured, and to allow the code to develop slowly and incrementally over time, rather than spending a lot of effort at the beginning of the process trying to guess what the structure of the code could be. So that he came to call that test-driven development. There's a variant of that called behavior-driven development, the differences of which are, for our purposes, really minor, but you'll sometimes hear that term. And that's sort of the two ideas of testing that sort of live in especially web development and all kinds of development right now. You have one school of testing where you're writing automated tests largely before you write code for an application, you know, in small increments in order to learn things about the design. And then you have a whole nother kind of automated testing, which you do primarily for verification after the fact. Most of what I'm writing about in this book is the test-driven test driving design part. But obviously the ability to automatically to write tests that will automate validation that your code's doing what you wanted to do, that's also very valuable.
So it sounds like whether it's test-driven development, behavior-driven development, manual testing, or automatic testing, code that is going to be used by many people on a production level needs to be tested somehow, some way. And I think that as a code newbie, the idea that my code needs to be tested just didn't really intuitively make sense to me. Can you walk me through a really simple example of something that I would write that I would need to test? And what would happen if I didn't test it?
One interesting example from my own experience, I spent a couple years working at Motorola, writing software that output router configuration files. I don't know anything about router configuration files. I didn't know then. I don't know now. Somebody handed me a configuration and a test configuration. This is what the output of this code should look like. And what was interesting about that setup is that that left a lot of ways for my code to be wrong. Like my code could run and it could do what I thought it did, but it wouldn't necessarily do what it actually needed to do. And one of the advantages of the tests in that particular context was that the tests wound up being a concrete example of what the code actually needed to do. So then I was able to use the tests to compare what my code was actually doing, not just with what I thought it was doing, but also with what the people who were domain experts or who the customers were actually needed it to do. So that's one place for automated testing, is to make concrete that gap between your knowledge as the developer, your customer's knowledge or your domain expert's knowledge, and what your user actually should experience.
So I understand that as a developer, but I think that that example is still a little too abstract. Can we try a different one that is like really, really, really simple? Like explain it to me like I'm five simple.
Well, at the very simplest level, the reason why you test things is the same reason why you would validate anything, because we are all flawed and we all make mistakes. And we, in particular in code, we have the problem of, especially as systems get larger, we have the problem of a change that we have made in our code breaking something else that we're not even looking at. And one of the advantages of testing in that context is that it protects you, ideally, against that problem, that you've changed, that you've broken some behavior inadvertently. And on a complicated system, that doesn't even have to be a change that you've made. You could have a system that depends on a third-party tool. You know, you're writing a web application and it depends on the Twitter API or something like that, and the Twitter API changes and your code breaks. You test things because you need them to work and because it's the only way to verify that they work. I have a coworker who does QA at TableXI at my company, and he says that the way that he puts it is that he says, as developers, it's your job as developer to be optimistic about the code, and it's his job as a tester to be pessimistic about the code.
I like that. Yeah.
So to look at the code and not see like, does this work, but to see how could this break? Like what happens if somebody, it's almost impossible as you develop to take advantage, to think about all the possible things that could happen. Like just a simple web form. Like what happens if somebody puts in a string that's too long? What happens if they put in an empty string? What happens if they put in a string with a weird character? Like you can control for all of those things in automated tests. Whether it makes sense to do so, depends on exactly what you're doing. But testing in general is a way to just ensure that your code is doing what you think it's doing.
That's a really good example about things that users put in, because that's probably one of the most unpredictable ones. And especially if you have people who just kind of want to mess with you. One thing that my fiance likes to do as soon as I give him something that I just built is he will just put in like 1,000 zeros, just because he just wants to see, like, did you think about the possibility that somebody would put in 1,000 zeros? And so if you have someone like that, testing can be very helpful.
Yes. Yeah. Some people just have the gift. Like this was something I did about maybe a year ago. I was writing a system that was taking in tickets and donations, and I had just written the first version of the thing that was taking in donations. So you would put in an arbitrary number and it would say, you know, it would treat it as a donation to the organization that we were writing this for. And somebody on my team that was acting as a tester, like, put in negative $50 and it processed a donation of negative 50, which, you know, would be really convenient if you were a user of the system. Yeah. So that kind of thing. It's always good to have somebody or some process looking over your shoulder and making sure that things behave the way you expect. So yeah, I mean, when you're dealing with testing for verification, then in particular, you're looking at exceptional or unusual conditions.
So it sounds like if I were to do this manually, I would, you know, think of all the different combinations and type in the form and submit it and see what I get. And automatic is when the program does that for me in, you know, a fraction of the time that I could do it myself. Is that kind of the difference?
Yes. Yeah. So there are all of these different, you know, there's a whole range of tools that are specifically designed to automate user activity. You know, again, in web development, we have Selenium and there are a couple of others, and there are similar tools like Java. Java, I think, has a standard library thing called Robot, which you can use to program interactions with swing components. I haven't used that in a really long time. But yeah, that enables you to do what's sometimes called acceptance testing, where you're testing the system, you're automatically testing the system from the perspective of a user. You're trying as best you can to interact with the system the way a user would, clicking on buttons, validating output that a user would see, and not worrying about the internals of the program. The contrast there is unit testing, where you are writing tests that interact with the internals of the program. Those are typically things that a developer writes for their own purposes, as opposed for, you know, to the validation of the entire project as a whole.
So for unit testing, it's more of if I wrote a method and I want to make sure that method is returning the right thing. Is that kind of the thing that I would use for that?
Right. So when we're talking about unit testing, when we're talking about validating unit tests, then we're talking about things that would care about individual pieces of the code. So yeah, you would set up a test that would be like, well, we'll stick with that ticketing example. So you'll say like, okay, I'm just going to set up an object that's a user object, and I'm going to set up an object that is my purchase object, and I'm going to create a donation object, you know, with negative 50, and I'm going to ensure that somewhere in the system, you know, this particular piece of the system that I'm looking at, not that this particular piece is going to block that. It's going to say that it's an invalid entry, you know, as opposed to an acceptance test, which might say, I hit this URL, you know, I fill this box with this value, and I see that this output happens.
So acceptance test is really from the user's perspective going through the whole system, and unit is more of like a piece of that system that is required to have the user see whatever they see.
Right. There's actually three separate pieces here. A unit test, which talks about a particular piece of the code, ideally a very small piece of the code. What's called an integration test, which talks about multiple pieces of the code interacting together, different layers that talk to each other. And then an acceptance test, which has the added, which is an integration test that usually covers the entire system from beginning to end, and also has the piece of it that it is not just, you're not just validating that the code does what the developer thinks it does, but that it also does what the customer expects it to do.
It makes sense to me that I would write some code and then see if it does what I think that it does and what I hope that it does. But the idea of writing the test first, can you explain to me why that is better than writing the test afterwards?
The answer to that is maybe. Like, some people never quite take to it, and it makes a lot of sense to some people, and some people don't ever, it never quite feels right to some people. And that's okay. Like, one of the things that is true about software development, and I think this is especially important to get across to people who are new to software development, is software development is complicated, and there are a lot of ways to be successful. Testing in a particular way is a way that I have found to be successful, and I can explain to you why I think I'm successful with that, and I can show you what made you successful with that. But ultimately, everybody's going to be successful in their own way. So, you know, that's an important place to start. One of the advantages of writing tests first is there are a few pieces to this. One is that it really encourages you to build the code in small incremental pieces, that you write a test that covers the very incremental next piece of functionality you want, and then write just the code that makes that pass, and then look at the code critically at that point and see if there are pieces of it that feel too complicated, if there are pieces of it that feel like there's duplication, and that kind of thing. And what that allows you to do is build up the code base. By building up the code base that slowly and that incrementally, it really makes it easy to see complexity growing, you know, complexity coming up before the complexity becomes so overwhelming that it becomes hard to simplify. It enables you to like really look at, hey, you know, this line, this method is starting to get to the point where I don't feel good about it, and I can break it up, or I can move some of the code around and restructure a little bit. And another advantage of that is that writing the tests first acts as a way of planning out the code in a very small scale. One of the things that a lot of the methodologies that get grouped together under the agile buzzword, one of the things that a lot of those methodologies do is they take something that would be hard if you only do it once in a while, and they say, try to come up with a way to do that continuously in small pieces and it'll be easier. And testing first is one of those parts. Like, writing tests can be complicated, but if you write tests in small pieces and you write them before the code, it becomes much easier to write the tests. And you can then use the tests to plan out exactly how you want the piece of code to behave. You know, what do I want this class to be named? What do I want this method to be called? What do I want the arguments to this method to take? You know, in order to write a test for a new piece of code, you actually have to think about those things before you write the code. And then you have this test, which documents the behavior you want, ideally, although that doesn't always, it's not always the best documentation in practice, that describes a small little piece of code. And you've had the chance to think about issues of structure and issues of naming that are going to be really valuable to get in, to be in the habit of thinking about in very small bursts. And ideally, this doesn't take very much time. You know, if you're doing it in small pieces, this takes a minute or two. Whereas if you come back to write tests, you know, if you've written a week's worth of code and then you come back to write tests for it, you're going to find writing unit tests to be very hard because the code hasn't been structured in such a way to expose things to make unit tests easy. When you write tests before you write code, you also have this interesting advantage. This sort of guides you, or it encourages you to write your code in such a way that you have a lot of small methods that return specific values that you can test. And it encourages you not to have code where there are a lot of things that happen in side effects that aren't the return values of methods, or things like that. And it turns out that the kind of code that has a lot of small methods that return unique values and don't do things as side effects, that kind of code becomes much easier to deal with as your system becomes more complex.
I think that as a new programmer, the disconnect happens with the phrase, write your tests for your code first, because you haven't written the code. So it's like, what am I testing? How am I testing something that I haven't written?
So in order to do that, and it's a planning session, and it's thinking about the things that you need to think about, but just sort of thinking them in a different order, but with a different emphasis. You know, when you sit down to write code, you're sitting down to write a new feature to an application. Let's talk about, you know, this. Keep on this ticket, or, you know, we're talking about adding donations to this ticket system. In order to do that, there are a lot of things I need to think about. I need to think about how the donations are going to get stored in the database, how they're going to interact with other purchases, how whatever thing that is calculating how much money to claim to the credit card gateway, like all kinds of details like this. When you think about this, when you start to write the tests first, it gives you a way to think about this all of those details can be overwhelming if you try to solve them at once. When you try to write the tests first, it enables you to think about these in very small incremental ways. Like, what is the first thing that I need to worry about? And as if you're coming at this as a new person and you're thinking about, I don't even have code. How do I think about tests? I think one way to cross that bridge is to think about, you need to think about this in three stages. You need to think about what, first of all, like what actually do I want the code to do in this case? What action am I actually trying to test? And then on both sides of that, you think about like, well, on the one hand, like what data do I need for that to be able to execute that action? And then what change in the system do I expect to see as a result of that action that I can write, that I can specify in a test and say, I expect this value to now be this. And so I think that one way to look at this is not to look at this as I'm trying to test code that I haven't written yet, but to think of it as I'm trying to describe a behavior of my application. It happens that that behavior doesn't exist yet, but I'm trying to describe some way I want my system to behave. And then the system will come along later and behave that way. But when I'm thinking about it at the beginning and I'm writing a test, I'm really thinking about like, what do I want the system to do? And in some ways, that's a very similar process to the way that it would happen if I were to sit down and write the code first. I would say, what do I want this to do? But instead of actually doing it, I'm starting off by thinking about like, by describing it almost. Like, what do I want it to do? What change do I expect to see as a result of it? And what data do I need in the system in order to be able to even run this unit, run this individual piece of code?
Yeah, I mean, it's like how you described it earlier, you're planning. Like, you are planning and thinking through what the outcomes and what the point is. I mean, it's almost like if you have a dinner party, the first thing you do is not to go into the fridge and pick ingredients and just start, you know, chopping onions. Like, you're going to say, okay, I need an appetizer, and it should be something light, and then I'll have the main course, and it should be chicken. You know what I mean? Like, you plan it out, and then you go in and you cook.
And even, yeah, and taking that analogy one step further, you might also say, like, I need all of this stuff to be ready at 7. Like, that means I need to start the roast at this time, and I need to start
Yeah.
So, you know, it can even be a little bit more structured than that.
I think that the hard part about planning for something is if you're planning a system that you don't understand quite yet, the testing part can be pretty overwhelming. So in the dinner party example, if you've never been to a dinner party, never heard of one, and you don't know the pieces, and so it's kind of hard to plan through something that when you don't know how it's supposed to look anyway, how do you get over that?
So that's actually really interesting, because actually like that's a hidden assumption of test-driven development, right? The test-driven development kind of assumes that you know what your output is going to look like. You know, in order to write a test first, you need to just the part that I said, and just the way that I said it, like you need to be able to define what that expectation is, what that change is. And if you don't know what that change is, the test-driven development is really challenging and may not even be the way to go. There are a lot of like front-end activities, for example, where you're just trying to design the front-end kind of as you go, and you don't really know what you're looking for, and test-driven development really doesn't work in that case. The agile methodologies have a concept for working around that. The concept called a spike. And in a spike, what you're doing is you are writing code. It's like a proof of concept. You're writing code you're basically testing. You're writing code very quickly without tests, just to make sure that you understand the problem domain that you're trying to build. The idea is that you build the code using the spike, and then when you get to the point where you think you understand it, you go back and you build it again. Using test-driven development. And ideally, you don't keep the code that you've written. Like you write all of this scratch code and you kind of throw it away. A lot of people don't like the idea of throwing away code, and they'll redo it in some other way, or they'll try to use some of it. But you know, like at its most pure, like that's the idea. Like you do a spike, you write enough code to the point where you understand the problem, and then you throw it away and you do it for real test first.
I remember when I first heard of that term, and it was at RailsConf last year, and I was so excited because that's pretty much what I'd been doing, and I didn't know that that was a thing that people did because, you know, especially when I was working with an API or a gem or just something that I didn't really know how it worked, I would just, you know, write up a couple methods and try stuff out and play with it, and once I said, okay, these are the return values that I can expect, this is how the system works, then I would go back and actually do test-driven development. But I love that that's a thing. Like, it's okay to play around and experiment and then just throw away your code. And that's just part of the process.
Yeah. And it's a real thing that you do on real projects. Like, I you know, it is not unusual to say, like, it's not unusual on the projects I work on to say, like, yep, I need to spike this for a little bit before we do it. Now, obviously, you're going to have project managers and people who are going to be more and less receptive to that kind of thing. So, you know, that that's always an issue. But yeah, if you're doing an agile process, if you're using you know, the Kent Beck's sort of original extreme programming methodologies, which include testing first and which include this concept of a spike, it's a really valid thing to do. And there are other things that I find challenging to test first, like to do test first. Like, a lot of times, if I'm writing code and it's display logic, I often have to see it in the browser before I can start writing tests for it. And so I often need to see at least one version of it and then go, okay, yeah, that's the structure of it. Like, this piece is going to be subordinate to this piece, so I can have the test look for that. And you know, one of the things that helps me get away with that is I know to still write code in small pieces. So I'm not letting the code get too far ahead of the tests. And I kind of have a sense of the kind of small methods and things that make the writing tests still valuable or make writing tests later a little bit easier. But yeah, there are still some times where writing the tests first is really challenging. And I think it's important to, you know, as with a lot of different programming techniques, it's important to be able to get to the sense where you can understand, like, yeah, I'm having a problem doing this way. Maybe I should try a different way. Or maybe the fact that I'm having a problem doing something this way means that that there's something wrong with my code structure, or my code structure could be improved. Wrong is a loaded term, but that my code structure could be improved, or that my approach, that I could try a different approach that might be more successful.
So at what point in a code newbie's journey do you recommend they start thinking about testing? Is that something that you start, you know, day one? Is it after you're comfortable with the language? When is the right point for that?
I would probably be more aggressive about teaching test techniques than other people would. I mean, it is hard to do if you're not already comfortable with the language. So you need to, you know, if you're using a language, you need to be comfortable with the language kind of first. One of the hardest things in testing is if you're testing and you don't even know enough about the framework or the tools you're using to evaluate whether you have a problem, whether your problem is in the test or in the code. That can be very, very frustrating. So I think there's a certain amount of baseline knowledge of the language or the frameworks that you're using that you need to have. But I think that if you can get yourself in the habit of writing tests before code, if you can get yourself into that habit early, it's a good habit to have, and it becomes a harder and harder habit to cultivate over time. Not impossible, obviously, just like any new technique, you know, the more invested you are in other techniques, sometimes you have to unlearn a little bit to learn a different way of doing things.
Any final words of advice or encouragement or warning on testing for code newbies?
I think that, like, testing for me, like, I first started doing test-first development, and I first started reading about it at a time when I was getting very frustrated with my ability to deliver quality code. And I found that test-driven development really, really made me happy. Like, it made me happy on a very small level. Like, it gave me a lot of small incremental goals and a lot of small incremental successes over time. And that it really, like, it meshed well with the way that I thought about doing code, and I found the process really satisfying and soothing even. And so I think that there's a lot of sense that, oh, you know, writing test-driven development is hard. It can be fragile, and all of that can be true. But I think also there's a possibility, you know, that it will, that you will have an experience with it like I did, which is you will find that it will make coding more fun. Like, it makes incremental coding a little bit easier because there's a little bit less you need to keep in your head at once, because you're focused on smaller pieces at once. That the continual sense of, hey, my test passed, is really encouraging and gives you a lot of small micro encouragements to get through the day. So I, you know, that's the kind of encouragement. Like, I found this process to be really, really helpful, not in a grim, like, somebody told me I needed to do it and so I do it kind of way, but in a, like, this working this way really is, I find, like, fun and relaxing.
Yeah, when I first decided to kind of get serious about test-driven development and to really learn and understand the process, I found it really hard and kind of frustrating, but it was completely worth it, because especially as a beginner, you have so many doubts and questions on, does this work? Am I on the right track? And when you're writing your tests first, you have a process, you have guidelines, you have, you know, little questions to answer as you go. So if nothing else, just knowing that you created your own direction and your own roadmap is incredibly empowering and just gives you a sense of confidence and peace of mind.
Yeah. And you also have boundaries too. You have, like, okay, I know this doesn't handle a null input yet, but I don't care yet. Like, I know this code is going to break with null, but all I need to do is I write a test where I pass in null and see what happens, and I can fix it at that point. Like, there's this wonderful sense of, I don't need to solve every problem at once. I can just solve one problem at once, that I find really great.
Yeah, you get so much focus. You get to say, I'm going to just worry about this part. I'm going to start here, and eventually I'll get to this other part later. And that's so, so helpful, definitely as a new programmer. So now I'd like to move on to some rapid fire fill in the blanks. Are you ready?
Yeah, I think I am.
Number one, worst advice I've ever received is?
See, like, this was the one that I was gonna, this is the one I knew I was going to struggle with. Maybe the worst advice I ever received I didn't take, which was that very early on in my career, I had a job opportunity between a small web consulting company and a larger telecommunications company that wanted me to do research, wanted to hire me to their research department. And the larger company clearly would have been more stable. The smaller company would have been more fun. And I definitely had people that were encouraging me to choose the more stable option that was not a job that I wanted. And that might be the worst advice. I've gotten a lot of bad advice about running projects over time.
So why was the stable one, why was that a bad advice?
Well, it was not a bad choice for other people. I think that they wanted me to do the kind of work that I would have done there wouldn't have been research in the sense that I was used to, and it wouldn't have been using tools that I would have enjoyed using. And I think it would have been I don't think it would have been something I would have enjoyed. Whereas actually going to the smaller company, I went to the small company. I was actually fresh out of a graduate program, but didn't have professional experience, and went to a smaller company where I was able to be, I was handed a very wide range of things to do. One of the great advantages of small companies, is that, you wind up doing a little bit of everything. And I wound up doing a lot of things that I might not otherwise. You know, I got to participate in sales meetings. I talked to customers about deployments. I talked to customers about requirements. I set code standards for projects. Like, this was a team of people that really didn't have much software background at all. This was, you know, about 15 years ago, and really got experience of doing real software projects with real clients end to end in a way that I almost couldn't have gotten at a larger place. And certainly, you know, if I was in a research area where I wasn't really client focused and probably would have been doing very, very similar stuff over and over for a while, I don't think that would have worked out for me.
So it's interesting. It kind of goes into this category of what is the motivation for other people's advice. Do you feel like they gave you the advice to pick the stable job because they understood your needs and your goals and kind of thought that was a better fit? Or were they kind of thinking, well, I would pick the stable job, so that's what you should pick?
Yeah, I think it was more the second one. I think it was very, I had a very hard time articulating in advance what I thought I would get out of the smaller company in a different way. And I think that people who, I was unconvincing to some people.
Number two, my first app was about.
There's all kinds of ways to define this. Like, what first app? Like, the first thing I wrote on my own was when I was in high school, was probably like a flashcard thing in Turbo Pascal that did my Spanish flashcards, Spanish language, that, you know, did random Spanish language flashcard testing. Or actually, it might have been in Basic, like AppleSoft Basic.
Was that for the Spanish class that you were taking?
Yeah, I was taking high school Spanish and wrote just a vocabulary tester.
I feel like your parents must be so proud of that. Like, here's this kid who
built... My parents may not have known that I was doing it.
I was like, that sounds like the most model student thing ever. Like, you took the time to write a program for Spanish flashcards for your Spanish class so you could do better in school. That's great.
Yeah, it's entirely possible that I'm overselling the amount of programming that was involved in this.
That's okay. Just run with it. Go with it.
The first thing that I did professionally, the first project that I worked on professionally, was a web application that was an internal intranet, what we would call it now, an intranet for a company that sold orthopedic surgery equipment. Every bit as exciting as it sounds. But again, this was long enough ago that a lot of the things that we kind of take for granted as structurally. So again, this was about 15 years ago, and like the production server was under my desk and was also the development server because we did not know any better.
that sounds so dangerous.
It sounds what? Dangerous? So yes. Dangerous. Yes, it was. Yes, dangerous. Yes, yes. There's a reason why this is no longer the structure. Like, we didn't have, we didn't use source control because we didn't know any better. I'm starting to sound like get off my lawn. Like, we like we coded uphill both ways. But you know, we were just, this was just, you know, this was the conventions were, you know, this was at a point in web development, particularly where the conventions around how to structure stuff just were in the process of coming together. And so the tooling, you know, was, you know, very, was not as advanced as it is now. And as a result, we couldn't do nearly as much. I'm not trying to sell it as a golden age. Like, we literally had no idea what we were doing or what good practices were, and made like every mistake you can imagine. And you know, it took 3 months to do something that that somebody with the Rails framework, we had a team of five that took 3 months to, well, actually this was a larger project that I did a little bit later, but you know, it was a team of five that took 3 months to do something that a single Rails programmer could probably do in 2 weeks these days. So, you know, the tools change and improve all the time.
Number three, one thing I wish I knew when I first started to code is?
When I first started to code professionally, I think that, and I'll draw the line there. When I first started to code professionally, I think that one of the things that I wish I had known then that I came to learn fairly painfully over the course of the first few years was how much of a development job does not involve coding. You know, how much of a software project involves figuring out what, you know, I've spent a lot of time in consulting, so a lot of my examples tend to sort of be and have a sort of a consulting accent. But to think about what does the customer want. How do we give it to them? How do we best give it to them? What do we do when the customer wants to do something that you think is ridiculous? How do we deliver that to them? How do we get them to acknowledge, to understand what we've done? How do we explain that something took more time than we thought it was going to without sounding like we're trying to sell used cars? And you know, like a lot of that stuff that I learned early on and was really surprising at the time in terms of just how much of the delivery of a real software project involves being successful with things other than the ability to just code.
Which I think is really great news for a lot of people in our community who come from not, you know, technical backgrounds and that come from more, I guess, social backgrounds.
Yes.
Yeah. That makes more artsy backgrounds.
Well, yeah, right. No, I think that that's great. Like all of those skills, all of those liberal arts kinds of skills, those are all really valuable. I love to see people come through. I spend a lot of time interviewing relatively inexperienced candidates, and I love to see people that have experience where they might have experience that is similar to some of our clients and have the ability to understand some of their needs, or even just have, you know, like performance experience or some sort of communication experience. Like all of that stuff winds up being useful. Even if you think the job, you know, if you think the job is just typing, like all of the stuff that's not just typing, all of that stuff winds up being useful.
So next we're going to do some shout outs. Do you have a couple for us?
So I actually think I do. I want to shout out a guy named Kent Beck. Kent Beck has written a number of books. The most notable is probably the original Extreme Programming Explained book, which is the source. He didn't invent all of these techniques, but he popularized the idea that of what eventually became called agile development, and popularized the idea of test first development and pair programming and continuous integration and all of these things that are just as natural as breathing, especially within like the Ruby community. All of this stuff kind of floats back to the original Extreme Programming book and some other things that Kent Beck has written. He wrote a really good book on test-driven development, which I think might be called Test-Driven Development. And he also wrote a book called Small Talk Best Practice Patterns, which, even though it is nominally about small talk, is actually a tremendously good and interesting book for a number of different languages that have that are similar to small talk. Like it's actually really valuable, has some really valuable advice for Ruby developers and Python developers and anybody who's working in that kind of dynamic language. Really interesting guy. He still writes. I actually think he's employed by Facebook right now as a consultant. So he occasionally posts technical things on their blog. He has a relatively recent screencast series from Pragmatic on test-driven development in Java that's worth checking out. So that would be one person that I would want to shout out. And another tester and another thing that I wanted to just mention that you guys might not be aware of is Justin Searles. Justin maintains a lot of open source testing tools and a lot of other open source projects. He's responsible for the Lineman tool in JavaScript. He also has a lot of testing libraries that he maintains and things like that. Justin gave the keynote, one of the keynotes at RubyConf a couple weeks ago about, it's called the Social Coding Contract. And it's about being an open source maintainer and being part of a community. It is available on Confreaks now. It was really great, and people should check that out.
Anything else you're forgetting?
Like my own stuff?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. I have a book out, Rails 4 Test Prescriptions. By the time you hear this, it might actually be a physical object in print, or it will be available as an ebook and a soon-to-be physical object in print from the Pragmatic Press. You can get that at pragprog.com and search for Rails 4 Test Prescriptions. It's also available on Amazon. I also self-publish a couple things. You can go to noelrappin.com, and I have two self-published books, one of which is called Master Space and Time with JavaScript. And that covers, it talks about developing in JavaScript. It talks about testing in JavaScript quite a bit. And it also talks about a couple of different frameworks. It talks about Backbone and it talks about Ember. It's a little out of date, but some of it's going to get refreshed shortly. And I also have a self-published book called Trust-Driven Development, which is about projects. And it actually relates to the stuff that I was just talking about the parts of the job that aren't typing. Some of that's covered in the book, in the Trust book.
So I have a few shout outs of my own. The first one is something that I think it was Julie Torres, one of my favorite people in the CodeNewbie community. She pointed this resource out to me. It's called RSpec Cheat Sheet, and it is a cheat sheet provided by Thoughtbot that has just really great examples and definitions of some basics on how to use RSpec. And RSpec, if you don't know, is a very, very popular testing tool for the Ruby language. So definitely check that out.
And it is also the main testing tool covered in Rails 4 Test Prescriptions.
And the final thing, and this is really just for fun, It's called Christmas Countdown, and it's done by Jessica Aguiming. Jessica, I'm so sorry. I know I totally messed that up. But she has this really great portfolio project where it just counts down to Christmas. And it's really simple and really clean. But what I love about it isn't so much the project itself. It's the way that she explains how she does it. And I've had a lot of people recently ask me about blogging and portfolio and how do you demonstrate your work as a person learning to code. And I think that Jessica does a really, really great job of this. She has, you know, just one page, a couple paragraphs explaining the tools she used, the problems she had, and the takeaways that that she got from doing that project. And it's a really clear, concise way of displaying her knowledge and what she's excited about. So if you're looking for a good example on how to show a portfolio and how to show what you're learning and kind of demonstrate your coding journey, I would definitely check out all of her work and use that as an example because it's really, really well done. If you want to join the conversation, you can join us on Code Newbie Discourse, our new online forum for people excited about code, or you can chat with us every week on the Code Newbie Twitter chat. Just search for #CodeNewbie and tweet with us every Wednesday evening at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You can learn more about that as well as show notes for this episode on codenewbie.org/podcast. If there's a topic you want to hear about or a guest you want to hear from, send us an email, hello@codenewbie.org. Thank you again, Noel, so much for joining us. You want to say goodbye?
Yeah, thanks for letting me be here. This was fun.
Thanks for listening and see you next week.